interested in discussing the factors which contribute towards the formation of psychopathic and homosexual personalities, and explain whether lifelong tendencies towards harmful conditions are inherited or acquired. Well, when we're talking about psychopathic states and personality or individuality, we have to represent the personality to the circle. Only in so far as we draw the circle that is defined in the environment, can we talk about a personality or an individuality. To be an individual at all is to be in a state of divisibility. You are an individual insofar as you can be divided from the rest of the universe. So we represent any individual by means of the circle. We want to account for pathological states. Homosexual states mentioned here may or may not be pathological. We can personally deal with the homosexual state and see how it arises. If we start off with a single cell, and the cell has a nucleus in it, then it's surrounded by a mass of protoplasm and cytoplasm. The intelligence in the nucleus here is really the intelligence in the field working through the nucleus into the surrounding cytoplasm. While I'm drawn going to the center, shouldn't be drawn any time process at all. It should be drawn as from the field of the universe, operating through a center into the time process. It is operating through the center from the field in order to meet a stimulus from outside the limiting factor of the field coming from another. When we draw a circle for the individual, we have arbitrarily placed this circle around the zone of the universe in order to consider. Actually, there is no material in the universe that is absolutely self-existent. Every parcel of matter, as is today known factually, is merely a modality of energy or force or power. Consequently, if we want to represent a circle more accurately, we should represent it as a force coming in from the infinite field and rotating and going out. This is like a birth and death diagram for an individual. Now, if we were to imagine a being like a single cell provided with a living subsystem, an energy source, either by food or by direct radiation, and a nuclear intelligence, a field intelligence, central power, feeding into the center and from the center into the surrounding system, then if there are no external forces acting upon it, it necessarily acts correctly and always healthily. That is to say that from the center of the being, there are no psychopathic tendencies. The centrality of the being guarantees that the being is moving towards health. The central impulse of the being is guaranteed by the field which is centered upon this nucleus, in order to order the protoplasm. If we cut the nucleus out fairly swiftly, the cytoplasm around it will degenerate and corrupt. If we cut a piece of the protoplasm off, on the side where the nucleus is, it will heal itself and again attain a condition of wholeness. So through the nucleus is coming the intelligence that orders the cytoplasm around it. From the center of the being, there is only health. But this is not quite the same thing as being free from transition from one place to another. Suppose we take a seed and we place this seed in the ground. Christ said, if a seed does not fall to the ground and die, it will abide alone. And if it falls to the ground, then it will corrupt, it will break up. He who does this in February, whence the word febrile comes from, it strikes itself and then it puts out a seed. Root down and shoot up, and it begins to grow. Now, if the seed is perfect when you see it, it may look very beautiful, very simple, round or oval shape, or very complicated shape, and many different shapes of seeds. They're all basically spheroidal, with distortions introduced by the prayer forces in them and in the environment. But in order for this seed to become a full-grown plant, whether it's a blade of grass or a tree, it has to break itself down. Breaking down, corruption of the seed, is not a bad thing. It is an essential thing for the seed to become a full-grown plant. So we cannot call the breaking down of the seed a pathological state. Now let's look at another thing. An amoeba is a monocelled animal which changes its shape as it's flying about according to the available food in the environment. If we imagine an amoeba to be basically a spheroidal form, and we place a bit of food on one side, it will flow towards that food and then surround it and ingest it. And the part, wherever there's a bit of food, the part that flows out from the amoeba we call a pseudopodium, a false foot, which is putting out temporarily to walk towards its food. And so an amoeba may be any weird shape, according to the available nutriment in the environing water. Now the amoeba is a pre-sexual being. And by pre-sexual, we mean to say that it has not cut itself into two and specialized the two halves. So that if we draw a single cell prior to its division, we cannot talk about it in any way as a sexual being. It is a whole being, and it has inside it the possibility of sectioning itself, because the amoeba will multiply by dividing itself. Actually, a single cell with the nucleus, when it wishes to divide, it first behaves in a certain peculiar way in the nucleus, and then it separates the nucleus and makes two nuclei within it, and then these two act across the space between another wall. By the action of the double nucleus, which is really the original nucleus split, it bombards across its cytoplasm and builds the wall between. And when the wall has been made, it then proceeds to pinch it gradually, thinner and thinner, until it eventually becomes two beings. And these beings, in the case of many of the mono cells, are apparently identical. That is to say, with all available present-day instruments, no sign of differentiation can be discovered of the type we call sexual. And if we imagine the situation in which a single cell parts by separating the nucleus, and then, having moved away from itself, so that it is now two beings, it has actually sectioned itself. So if these two beings have any relation at all, we can call it a sexual relation. It has sectioned its wholeness. It has torn itself apart and become two beings. Now, if you watch under the microscope, you will find that monocells of this type do come together periodically, and when they come together, they will press against each other, and they will fuse and let their cytoplasm flow one into the other. And this is a type of bisexual relation, because it cannot be said that one of them is more aggressive than the other at that level. The flow of energies is reciprocal. It passes both ways. Biologically, this enables experience to be multiplied in certain very interesting manners. If we take a cell and divide it into two cells and allow one of these cells to have an experience called A, another one to have an experience called B. They are now separate. Here is A and B. When they come together again, they join on the median line. And then the next time they separate this way. So you now have two beings, but they have both got A and B in them. So that by the process of fusing together on one line, or axis, and dividing on another axis, they're actually adding together their experiences. So that in the same time that A is having the experience, and B is having the B experience, when they put them together, it is just as A had had the experience AB, and B had had the experience BA. So that a complication or introduction of a variety of experience occurs in the fusion of the two halves. And this is the basic purpose of a sexual relation. It is the feeding in of experience into the two beings. It is not primarily for procreation, that is, for the creation of another child, other than the original being. That is its secondary purpose. Its primary purpose is to carry the information of experience from one being to the other, so that both beings are actually enriched in the exchange of forces, independently of whether a child occurs as a result. The fact that in nature you have only a matter of about 2 days when a woman can actually be fertilized out of the whole month shows you that the basic purpose of a sexual relationship is not procreation. It is the exchange of the forces of experience from one to the other, an enriching of both beings in the relation. Now, when two of these beings come together, sometimes one child has had an experience which is more vital than the other, more stimulating. Let's pretend that A has had a stimulation value of 10 in its experience, and B has had an experience of 2. When the two of them come together, A is more energetic than B, so that when they start pressing together to fuse, the A forces will penetrate the B forces before the B penetrates the A. Now, this is the beginning of sexual polarity, the first appearance of male-females. The side with the greater energy presses into the side with the less energy, and in the act of pressing, reduces the lesser energy side to a state of relative passivity. But the passive side is so pleased at the injection of energy into it that it starts a pincer movement on the energy and flows round it. So that if you look at this diagram, you can see the rudimentary form of male-female relationships. Now, it is only at this level that we can really talk about the specialized sexual relation, the sexual relation which is particularized genitally. The more aggressive side has made a prolongation, like the amoeba's pseudopodium, only it isn't a pseudopodium anymore, it's a genuine podium, which it can now utilize permanently as an instrument of aggression. The being aggressed against appears to like this type of aggression, and therefore it's very hard to persuade one to accept advice to keep away from those aggressive beings. Now, owing to the fact that there's a relative degree of intensity of energy in any given being, the polarity between beings is relative. That is to say, you might find a being, say A, that can aggress against a being called B, and coming up against another being called C, there might be a big fight, and maybe C will manage to penetrate A, while A is only slightly penetrating C. So this question of sexual polarity is entirely relative. There is no such thing as a merely masculine man or a merely feminine woman. Some women relative to some men are more masculine. Some men relative to some other men are women. That is, so they are in passive relation. So that when we come to consider the question of homosexuality, we must not consider it as a pathological state, but a state in which the being is moving towards the acquisition of more and more energy. And in the transitional phase, before it has made itself into the ideal being for the relation, the Vajra, Thunderbolt, Rod of Office, or whatever you care to call it, before it has modified its shape so that it is permanently such a penetrating being, it has a relatively lower degree of power to aggress, and therefore it is relative to some other being less masculine. So homosexuality is a state in which a being has not yet developed its full aggressive capacities. I'm using the word aggressive here in the sense of going into something. I'm not talking about morality or ethics, I'm talking about the energy to penetrate the situation. So there's no suggestion here that to be aggressive is to be wrong, morally or ethically. Aggression here is a natural thing where a stronger energy meets a relatively weak energy and therefore invades its territory more swiftly than the passive one is invading its territory. But there is always some passage from the relatively passive of energy to the relatively active. So the movement is always a both-way movement. It tends to be like the invasion of Russia by Hitler, where the enemy ranks are penetrated, there is a pincer movement to counteract it. Think about the homosexual problem merely as one of relative polarity, and then consider this. When a being is perfectly passive, of which the type is the ovum, carried in a woman, it is not mobile from itself. You know that when an ovum comes down the fallopian tube to be impregnated, it does not swim down on its own. It is pushed down by little processes in the tube. little hair-like processes or fingers inside the tube are there to push this passive ovum down the tube to meet a highly organized and active sperm. The sperm is the type of male aggressive force. The ovum is the type of female passive force. But there is a very peculiar balancing thing about this. To every action there's an equal opposite. It's a rule for the world of mechanics. But at certain levels, subatomically and in the field, the unifield of force, this law requires very, very careful consideration because it appears to be broken. When an ovum is surrounded by many sperms, as each of the sperms is different from the others in the energy it contains, and the ovum wants only the most powerful sperm, it is essential that the ovum should be able to resist them all. So that in fact, the membrane binding this ovum is so strong relative to the sperm that it can actually keep them all out. Now, if it couldn't do this, it could not discriminate and find the strongest. If it had a low threshold to let sperms in, then it could quite easily let a weak one in. So, in fact, it has a nice protection. Its binding surface is so strong that no sperm can get in without permission. This enables it to hold all the sperms out whilst it evaluates from which point the strongest knot is coming. And then wherever the strongest knot appears, when the ovum is quite convinced that this is really the strongest knocker and the most persistent, quite suddenly the wall of the ovum opens and the sperm slips inside and the wall immediately shuts again. Now as soon as it's shut, none of the sperms outside can get in. The ovum has actually accepted the most aggressive sperm. This is like a party where there's a girl surrounded by men, and it may appear that any one of them could knock her down. But in actual fact, she has the power to reject them all. And the only reason she's holding them at bay is to evaluate their relative force and persistence. Now, in the evolution of an egg, or a monocell, towards the active phase from the passive, this relatively passive suffers stimuli from the environment, and these stimuli inform the being, that is, they put forms of experience into the being. And as the stimuli vary in intensity, they are either pleasurable or painful, and the relative intensity of the stimulus determines whether this monocell can in fact assimilate the input of energy. If it can assimilate it easily, it calls it a mild degree of pleasure. If it assimilates it, but with a degree of difficulty, but is quite sure that it can assimilate it, it experiences great joy. And if the input of energy is so great that it cannot assimilate it, the energy input begins to destroy the pleasure of that being. It then experiences pain. Now, to avoid this pain, it stores up the experiences that it has and learns to move away from the pain, and thereby it becomes selective and considerate and what is called intelligent. But the accumulations of the experiences inside it, as it is adjusting to it, are actually turning this being progressively more and more from the passive into the active, providing the stimuli from outside do not actually destroy it and reduce it to total passivity, namely death. If it can assimilate these energies, it is gaining experience, and in the process it is developing what we call know-how. Now let's imagine one of these monocells, which has actually, this is merely a schematic drawing, not a biological one, actually got half of itself still unenlightened, that still dark urge moving towards what it wants. But on the other side, it has learned the forms of experience, and therefore it can understand itself. Now, if we like to write on the grid on the light to represent the play of light forms, on this dexter side of the egg here, we have what is called a male, that is an intellectually enlightened being. But the other side of this being is a female. It is still a relatively dark, urgeful being. And as we've drawn this particular egg with 50% in the dark and 50% in the light, that being would be a hermaphrodite, or a being balanced, male and female. It wouldn't be a pathologically definable being, it wouldn't be a being that is sick, it would be a being that has got 50% form and 50% undying rigid will, unformulated urge. Now, progressively, as it is going through, its experience will gradually enlighten it further so that the amount of light in it increases. And when it passes over to a certain level, then the organs, which were previously female organs, when the dark was dominant, that is passive receptive organs, now begin to change and gradually become more positive, more pushing, more aggressive, more searching, more penetrating, and the being passes into the phase of developing a genital organ, extroverted and aggressive. But this is only a phase to which it is going. It is not a pathological state. Now, there are many beings passing through from the so-called female to the male. There are many cases medically attested of women changing sex and becoming men. This occurs spontaneously when the form of the experience inside the woman becomes so much that it is actually greater than the undiluted conative drive, the pure will without the idea. When those passages from form occur to more form, we could say it's a movement from the relatively passive to the relatively more active. There are no medical cases, not one medical case, in which a fully developed man has ever turned into a woman. There are many cases of women developing, progressively masculinizing, and becoming men. It doesn't take more than a fortnight or 3 weeks to turn a hen by simple glandular injection into a cock that can father chicks. But you can't turn the cock back into a hen, because in the process of informing it, the form is again in power to aggress. And the being doesn't like to let go of power gain. So the movement can be considered as a movement from the passive towards the active. And each form gained tends to be retained. But when the being is 50-50, it is undecided what to be. So when we find someone near the middle line, around the 50-50, we will find the so-called homosexual case. And the 4% hardcore of homosexuals are really somewhere around this 50-50 line. And if you take just a little bit more light in, a little less dark, a little more active, a little less passive, we'll get the man who is aware that he's a man, but he still has so much woman in him that he can feel the pleasure of being impressed and being imposed upon. And he will be a transvestite. He will like to play at dressing up like a woman and so on. And these are not pathological states. They're merely phases of the development of a being from a relatively passive to a relatively active state. So we will pass from the consideration of the sexual problem to the consideration of the pathological problem. When we start with the egg, if we imagine the egg to be stimulated from outside, because we put a square stimulus on it, then there will appear inside, by the shape of the stimulus, a certain form, the square form, so that the consciousness of this being will be aware that a square exists. But the stimulus energy goes through the whole being. If we now put another stimulus, in this case a triangular one, onto the same being, the being is now thrown into the shape of triangles. And the triangles are lapping over the square. If we now put one stimulus, which is circle, then circles appear inside. Now, when forms from various stimuli are overlapping within the protoplasm and are not kept separate from each other, when such forms are presented, we call this a state of confusion. Confusion simply means that the forms of the stimuli have overlapped and fused together. Imagine here's a square, and here's a triangle, and here's a circle. And the forms of these are producing other forms, which are just the relations between the forms that are overlapping. So we can see many subsidiary forms within the square, circle, and triangle. And we can easily superstress any of these forms and produce a variety of shapes which in fact have no external correspondence. A hallucinated person who is seeing something that doesn't exist outside is really suffering from the confusion, the fusing together of various orders of stimuli. So in this state, where there is no internal subdivision, which we call the protoplasmic state, it's no discrimination whatever. We've done this before on various occasions, but we'll do it again. The whole egg, therefore, is going to be thrown into confusion by a multitude of stimuli, unless it can devise a method of protecting itself and departmentalizing itself. This method is the method of mitosis. The single cell sets up, by splitting its nucleus, a wall inside itself, but it does not separate into two halves and separate from, so that there are now two beings, but it sets a wall up inside itself and still retains its wholeness. Now, if we put the stimulus on one side of this being, half of the being is involved in the reaction and the other half is not. So if we divide this monocell into two halves, only half of it is conditioned by the stimulus arriving at one half. The dividing wall vibrates with the energy on the stimulated side, but the vibration is very, very slight and merely puts a very pale shadow in the free side. This pale shadow of an excessive stimulus, this pale shadow occurring in the conscious side, is what we call a non-objective anxiety. It's an apprehension that there is a threat, but the light side of it does not understand the nature of the threat, because the light side of it is not the side where the stimulus came. Now the cell goes on dividing, and every time it divides, it rescues a larger portion of itself from the stimulus. So if we go on dividing this original monocell into many tiny little cells, until we have literally millions of these things, as we have in a human being, we can see that if we put a stimulus on any point, the stimulus is relatively confined to a small area, and thus leaves the rest of the being free from that stimulus. Now what we call the act of consideration is the act of putting every single stimulus in a particular zone of the body and not letting it go from there, totopathic through the whole. So if we now have two stimuli, one of which is square and the other triangular, the triangle one is in a certain part of the being, the square one is in another part of the being. And the whole being can see the square in one part of itself and the triangle in another part of itself. And when it can actually do this, this being is said to have attained the power to discriminate. Discriminate means separate them. Create one over there and one over here. Just throw them apart, and by this process of mitosis, this cellular division, the being can have lots and lots of stimuli and keep them all separate. So in a highly complex activity like the consideration of the subject matter that we are now examining, we actually have in our mind all the different ideas separate, and they're occupying different frequency bands and different zones inside the protoplasm, and they are kept apart from each other when we are thinking clearly. If we overstimulate one particular zone by talking faster or louder than we can assimilate comfortably, then the energy begins to overlap large numbers of adjacent cells. This starts confusion again. In other words, it tends to produce an apparent regression to an earlier state, the protopathic state. So if you overload the average person with excessive stimulation from ideas and emotions, they will start behaving protopathically, that is, indiscriminately and emotively. But if, by training, you proceed to categorize all your ideas and you allot for each idea a little cubbyhole, a cell, you attain perfect discrimination. You may remember the Hindu teacher Vivekananda. His name means bliss through discrimination. Ananda is bliss, and Viveka means discrimination. And it is by the process of parting the totality of your experience and allotting cells to each experience that the state of discrimination is attained. Now when the being is fully discriminated in this way, it is stressed on the male side, that is the intellectual formal side. But if a series of very excessive stimuli are put upon this being that it is not used to, the cells may be actually damaged by the excess energy input, and the adjacent cells round about may have actually had destroyed a connecting link, a neuronic link or a synaptic resistance chain. So the totality of elements in consciousness now differs from the one that has been habitually present, and the person is for the time being confused. If they could retire to a desert island and wait a bit without treatment, they would spontaneously, from the nucleus, adjust themselves to reality. But if, in the social pressure environment, source of stress diseases we know of today so much, if in the social environment the pressures are being put on more and more, then more and more of the cellular divisions are being broken down, and the insulating virtues of having separate cells begins to deteriorate. Now, this is the source of the psychopathological state. That is to say, the excessive stimulation coming in too quickly for the being to assimilate and partition correctly is a pathological state. As soon as the thing comes in so fast that it cannot be assimilated, then already one element of the thing is out of control. It's the first brick built up towards a maladjustment of life. So to recap, homosexuality itself is merely a phase in the passage from the passive to the active, and the pathological is the unbalance of a being caused by external stimuli coming out too fast or too strong to be assimilated. Now, when we come to consider whether this is inherited or not, we can say two things about it, yes, no, according to how we define heredity. The word is frequently misused. If we take the root of hera, this means power differentiation. If we put the ditty on the end, which is part of the verb to speak or say, heredity is the outspeaking of the power, which is here saying what it has to say. Now, a few years ago, it was stated by all the pundits that it is a waste of time looking outside the nucleus for the factors of heredity. There is no heredity outside the nucleus. A series of experiments have proved that behavior patterns are actually appearing in a child that first appeared in the parents, the grandparents, and so on. So that if the word heredity is confined to the nuclear formal descent from the ancestors, if that is the true meaning of the word heredity, then the word used for the cytoplasmic form from the mother and father should not be heredity. So the thinkers who said, do not look outside the nucleus for the factors of heredity, were saying that the nucleus is the determinant factor of the formal behavior of any given being. But in practice, if you stimulate a mother with various forms of stimuli, electrical and so on, emotional, shouting, banging about, you actually also condition the protoplasm of the child. But you condition this child extranuclearly. In the cytoplasm, outside the nucleus, you leave a trace which will modify the behavior of the child. Now today they are calling this cytoplasmic heredity, which means that their original use of the word heredity for that which is coming through the nucleus has now been transcended. They have changed the meaning of the word. Whereas it once meant the form in the nucleus, it now means any form coming from a preceding generation. Now you may remember the experiment of the little lordly worm. The little worm which was conditioned by flashing a light on it and giving an electric shock at the same time. An electric shock was put in and the light was switched on at the same moment. And this little worm didn't like the electric shock. And because it was not parted like a man, in other words, because it didn't have the highly complex process of cellular division inside it, it became confused by the simultaneous input of the electric shock and the light stimulus. So the electric shock and the light stimulus overlapped inside that little worm, so that it responded to either as if both were present. And when this little worm was taken, after being shot several times and the light was switched on, this little worm jumped with horror, thinking that an electrical shock was coming. But it didn't come, but it thought it would. Next, our brothers, the Chinese scientists, get a knife and cut this little fellow in half. And they separate the two halves, and the top half grows a new tail, and the bottom half grows a new head. Now, when we switch the light on, both jump. So they then take the knife and cut them again. And again, the same process goes on. We now have four little lovely worms, and we switch the light on, and they all jump. Now, this means that the protoplasm, from generation to generation, retains the impressions of the stimuli put into it. Now, most people have the erroneous idea that they are separate from their parents. They think their parents have had a baby, not themselves, and that their parents have now cut themselves off from the child, and the child can now do as it wishes without being interfered with by the parents. But this is as silly as for one of these worms to think that it is not a quarter of the original worm. Because factually, the protoplasm that develops into any child is part of the protoplasm of the parent, the original protoplasm, not something totally different. A portion of the protoplasm in an adult sexually developed person is set aside for making sex cells. And when one of these cells is thrown out and joined to another bit, it makes a new being. So the new being is actually a piece of the protoplasm of the parent, which is why Kierkegaard says, as against the father, the son is always in the wrong. If you insult your dad, you're insulting at least half of yourself. And you will therefore feel guilty in the self-devaluation. So if we imagine that the human cell is conditioned by the shouting or jumping of parents, then we can see that the child will have, cytoplasmically, outside the nucleus, as well as inside the nucleus, some behaviors of power, which will appear as an individual behavior pattern, just like the little bits of the worm cut up behaved as if they had been shot when the light went off. What we call national consciousness is simply a collective engram, which was originally a very big engram. An engram is a record in the protoplasm put into the protoplasm by an external stimulus. Now, if you remember the showing to the Germans after the last war, the burning of people inside ovens by the Nazis, when the Germans were showed bodies inside ovens that had actually been put there by the Nazis, they were very, very shocked, and they said, "We didn't know that this was going on." Those of you who saw the newsreels of these things will remember that these people were trying not to look. They turned away, and they had inside them a very strongly charged cytoplasmic erythematous, a formal record of a body in an oven put there by the Germans. Now, they wish to repudiate this for the Germans, so they make a little record inside saying, "I don't want to be one of the people who is shown a roasted body after an unsuccessful war." And this message goes into the protoplasm and appears in subsequent generations as a tendency either not to want to make ovens to put bodies in or to keep out of war. The principle of the lordly worm is operative in the human being. When Christ said, "You are worth more than many sparrows," he was making a quantitative statement. A being with no divisions in it at all is protopathic, and when the stimuli come from all sides, it becomes confused. You could almost call it zero value, because it is continuously swamped by the situation. But it isn't quite zero, because the binding membrane round it has, to a certain extent, a threshold and won't let certain odors of stimuli in, and therefore it can discriminate where its food lies and where some biting acid lies in the water. But when the being makes its partition of the first kind, it is already approximated to individuation. That is, it can shelter itself from a stimulus and retain a portion of itself free to consider the nature of the stimulus. And the progressive movement towards freeing oneself from the stimulus is the movement towards masculinity. It is also the movement towards the capitalizing on the full hereditament of the human race. The human race has lifted itself up progressively from the amoeba over millions of years by the process of retaining the records of the number of times a little worm has jumped and putting it into a pattern within itself until it can deal with an ever-increasingly various environment. The object of human evolution is to be able to deal with any conceivable environment in any conceivable universe. When this object is attained, man is said to have become perfect. We will repeat that from the nucleus, the field forces of the infinite enter and spread into the surrounding cytoplasm. But the external stimulus from another being, the continued stimulus, tends to crowd this. Luckily, the nucleus is pretty well shielded. There's a very strong energy band around the nucleus in an egg, which is enough under all normal circumstances to stop the nucleus being disintegrated, so that practically all human beings who become ill from external stimulation can likewise have the effects of this external stimulation cancelled out, and they can then be restored to relative health. Plus the memory of the state they went through, the phases of the disorder, and so on, which is then added into their total understanding of the process of the human race. So that whatever pathological states we may consider, we must assert that they have an external origin, and that from inside the being, the nuclear embodiment is always towards health. But from outside the being, the cytoplasmic inheritance might work against the unity of the being, because it is defending itself against excessive stimulation in an unintelligent way. To be able to deal intelligently with the external stimulus situation is the same thing as to be able to integrate oneself into a total being and attain the state called perfection. Perfection meaning pure affection, or the gaining of a total actualization of reason in the being, in which every experience has its allotted place within the cellular structure and can be dealt with and brought into relation with all the others under the full control of the nuclear intelligence. We have another question which should require about 6,000 years to deal with. We'll try to deal with it in 6 minutes. It's about the book of Revelation. It is relevant to what we've just done, but we've been talking biologically, and now we're talking another way. Imagine the paper is the spirit, and when I wave the paper, the ripples upon it are represented by the lines I draw on the paper. Now, as long as the ripples do not create circles, then the motions of the paper can be said to be free. But as soon as the ripples overlap and make a zone which begins to rotate, as if I were to move the paper in a rotating manner, wherever a rotation occurs, then we have a finite structure, like a cell. Now, if we were to examine one of these beings, a single human being, parted into many cells, we can see the meaning of the fascist doctrine that a cell in the body has no meaning to itself in isolation. It has meaning only in relation to the whole being. But the cell doesn't know about the whole being, it only knows about its own purpose. Now, the fascist doctrine says a human individual is like a single cell within a human being, and he has no right whatever to act from himself as an individual, but must be subordinated to the whole. Within the bloodstream, the little cells, the white cells, the parasites, that are swimming about and eating up bacteria and so on, within the bloodstream, these little beings do not know that we exist. They are working for themselves. And if we proceed to throw lots of rubbish in our stomachs, poisons and so on, that they don't like, we have no ground whatever to expect them to obey by dealing as we would wish them to deal with this stuff and harmoniously assimilating it, when in fact it is unassimilable. What happens, of course, if we abuse the body too much, the cells of the body revolt. They start sending silly messages that we call irritations, inflammations, nervous breakdowns, and so on. A nervous breakdown is simply a rebellion of certain cells in the nervous system that are fed up with having a silly boss. And if we realize that a neurosis is a legitimate protest against balmy government, we won't think so badly about the neurotic, but only about the kind of government that it's been equipped with from its education. Now, in the book of Revelations, it is talking about free spirit, that is the movement of the paper, and any closed system whatever. Now, this closed system is simply a rotation of energy within the infinite field, and this rotation of energy is represented as a snake with his tail in his mouth. Now, this snake with tail in mouth is a symbol of all bondage, whatever. And we represent this by the zodiacal sign, Saturn. Saturn means the urn of being, the urn of sat. Sat is the same as the verb to sit and stand. The base ST means sit and stand. It means simply to be posited in a place. So Saturn means the urn of being. When the forces of the field rotate, they make an urn of being, I've drawn it two-dimensionally. If we'd like to spend a bit more time, we can draw the same thing as a spherical beam, going continuously backwards and forwards in a space and generating an oblate spheroid, something like the Earth. Every beam is made in this spheroidal manner simply because the only way of existing is to rotate. Now, the rotating system is always trying to stabilize itself. That is to say, when a stimulus comes to it, it tries to assimilate the stimulus in accordance with its own existing pattern. Whatever the pattern is already inside that closed energy system, when the stimulus comes from outside, from the infinite, it tries to bring the stimulus in and make it fit its pattern. Now, this is equivalent to saying that any finite being whatever will try to take the principle of free motion of spirit and reduce it to bondage. So Saturn is the principle of bondage in the universe. Now, this principle of Saturn is also called the devil, because devil means to divide, and this circle has divided the inside from the outside. Now, the book of Revelation is saying that all finite systems established in any universe ever, because they have been established as finite, they will try to condition the freely entering spirit from the infinite and force it to conform to the particular pattern of that finite. But no finite being can exhaust the infinite possibilities of the infinite field of sentient power beyond itself. And therefore, if any given finite structure tries to stop the entry of energy into it, it is actually an emissary of death. Now, death means to divide and separate and to stop the integration of one being with another. If you think you are alive and you are deprived of relationships totally, not even the TV, then you will begin to think you are dead because you have no relation. And when you are deprived of relation and yet your heart is beating and your blood is circulating and you are breathing, this is called a living death. Anything whatever that divides you from any other being is a death. And therefore this Saturn principle, Saturn Chronos, the principle of time, is also called the Lord of Death. But the creation of a finite zone is very useful for the creating of individual centers of reference. So although this bondage is also a death, mysteriously this bondage is the occasion whereby individuals within the bondage can, by the process of mitosis, of cellular partition, and the discriminating of experience, can actually make themselves into finite beings, separate from each other, but so internally integrated and formally inspired by their experience, that they can actually function in full self-conscious, reflexive awareness of themselves, other beings, and the field in which they subsist. The ideal of the field is to create a time being, a bound being, in order to produce an individuated being which will pluralize the possibilities of the infinite. Now, prior to the generation of a circle, within the infinite field of the absolute, the infinite field was exactly as silly as a protopathic monocell. That is to say, prior to the incarnation of man, God is as silly as an amoeba. And therefore, the field is totally aware of this and is determined to evolve for itself a zone of individuated awareness and to carry this zone by progressive experience through to a state of internal self-enlightenment, of which, of course, the classic example in history is Jesus, who attained such a degree of integration that he is quite capable of telling everybody on the outside to go to hell. In other words, he is the perfect individual. But his individuality is so great that he is quite prepared to give everybody else the power to tell everybody to go to hell, including him. He's a bit like Voltaire in that respect. The movement towards this process of self-individuation, reflexive self-awareness, is therefore a precipitation of the infinite field, which is called Jupiter, or God the Father. So Saturn itself, which is the devil, is simply the self-objectification of Jupiter, which is God. And therefore, in the book of Revelation, it says that God, for a time, times and half a time, which is symbolic, being half seven, 3 and a half. This, for this period, saturnine compression, individuation, is permitted. And all kinds of individualistic, egotistical, devilish, and horrible practices are permitted for this period of time, so that the process of individuation within the universe can raise itself to its optimal level. And when it has so raised itself, then logically the principle of individuation must be self-care. That is to say that every individual egotist will become so enlightened that he perceives that every other egotist is like himself. He becomes prepared to limit his egotism and bring it into relation with the egotism of other beings, so that the totality of egoic centers, psychons, or souls in the universe can actually attain a high degree of harmonized reciprocal relationships. But they cannot do this unless they are first egotistical, that is, first self-centered, concerned with their own development as individuals. And the more they become aware of this individuation fact, the more hard their exterior becomes, the less sentimental they become, in other words, the more aware they are of their devilish, diabolical tendencies, the nearer and nearer they approximate to the state of perfect fitness for a reciprocal relation, both with other finite beings and with the infinite field of spirit or sentient power which precipitated them for this reciprocal relation, a relation that the field gets the benefit of. When it is said in the book that God made us for himself, this is a statement of supreme selfishness. But God is not egoic. The God, the infinite spirit, is not himself egoic. That is, he is not a finite being. But because in the infinite he could not reciprocally act upon himself and show, manifest, fix, and establish his infinity of powers, therefore he precipitated an infinity of centers in order to show himself in the objective individuated level just what his potentialities were. And therefore, in relation to God, an individual human being stands in exactly the same situation as an individual cell does within the holy economy of the human being. When it is said, therefore, in the Revelations that God will allow the old serpent, the tail in mouth, the devil, Lucifer, and all other abominable terms, to persist for a time and a half. When he says this, he's saying no more than is logically implied in the idea of the descent into incarnation, the creation of a gross material reference point, the ground of egotism, but also the ground of individuation. So that in effect, the non-dual field, which has no sense of value as an infinite, develops within itself by progressive involvements in myriads of centers of reference for every one of its potentialities, and embodies all its potentialities, each in a different center. So that each center is a cell with a specific capacity, which is one of the potentialities of God, appearing in a human being as a special talent. Now, Christ is a bit hard about this. He says, if you have a talent, develop it and show a profit. Otherwise, I will take away from you the talent that you have. This is a direct warning that every human being is a center of a talent. That if you will not work towards the development of this talent, the discovery of this talent, even if it is only one talent instead of 5 or 10, if he will not work towards it, this talent, this energy, this seed power lent to him, will simply be taken back into the field and reposited elsewhere. Every value that an individual will not do, will not try to develop, will desert him and appear in another individual, which you can quite easily do because all the potentialities belong in the infinite field. When it works into one individual to establish itself, if something in the contingent relation makes it too difficult for it to establish it there, so that the intelligence in that place is factually not working towards integration, then it quite simply removes the stress of the field from this center to another center and carries on with the work in that center. So that if we examine ourselves as individuals, we will all find some peculiar thing. St. Paul says, one spirit and many, yes, diverse gifts of one spirit. Everybody can do something, even if it's only be awkward. And this particular talent should be discovered and developed to the nth degree. Some of the most interesting novels, which are really autobiographical sketches of writers, are nothing else but the history of the deficiencies of these people, turned into talents by deliberately utilizing them as means of stimulating other people. This means that there is nobody utterly devoid of the possibility of being somebody. So that even if you were no good, you could write a book about what it's like to be really and honestly and truly no good. So that even getting a publisher is nearly beyond him. So he writes to a newspaper and tells him, I can't even write to a publisher. Only he can't post a letter to the newspaper. So he drops it in the street. And somebody picks it up out of the automatic kindness of the infinite field. They stick a stamp on it and put it in the box, thinking it belongs to a little widow. But it makes a mark and it becomes a bestseller. The whole purpose of the infinite field is to pluralize the infinity of values it has, which at the infinite level are exactly equivalent to the protopathic confusion of an amoeba. And the human race has been evolved to help God to sort himself out. And if we don't do it, he's called a jealous God. Well, he won't work for us if we don't work for him. We have 5 minutes left.
How does birth control affect the
relation?
Yes. So has the do-away of the pattern of the knowledge between the male and the female.
You mean
birth control is used?
You mean mechanical contraception?
Yes.
You're better to do without them. Because they actually do insulate and impede the proper exchange of energies, apart from producing definite neuronic trends. You see, the neuron itself is controlled by the biomagnetic field. And if you're trying to defeat the relation in any way by using insulating materials, you are actually deeply annoying yourself because your deepest nuclear self doesn't want to do any such thing.
What do you
look at? Well, let's have a look at that. Somewhere about here, there are 2 days in the middle of a cycle. Well, it's quite easy to work it out, actually. And it's quite infallible, providing you're not greedy. There's an answer to menstruation, there's another one. Should we do it the Hebrew way and go this way, or should we do it this way? We'll do it this way. Now, from the answer to menstruation, in the Old Testament, if you bother to read it, which you won't, you will find that there is a period of menstruation and then a period allowed for recovery of the organism itself, because it displaces itself a little, and then it returns to its proper dwelling and regains its proper tonicity for the next fight. At the end of this time, which is the 12th day on the non-pathological cycle, on the 12th day, the law says that the lady in the cage shall have a bath. You know, it was said about Queen Elizabeth that she had a bath once a year, even if she didn't need it. So on the 13th and 14th days was the recommended period for trying to get a child. Now, this, in a 28-day cycle, would be about correct, providing there weren't another cunning process going on inside a woman in which she can actually adjust her biomagnetic fields and shift these 2 days about a bit. She has a very deep biological intent to become impregnated if possible, even though her intellect might realize the economy is rather difficult for a man who's already married and having another affair as well. So there is a degree of shift there. So to make it rather simple, we can cheat it because it cannot shift that too much. If we divide the thing into 4 weeks, and to make it easy mnemonic, because a lot of people can't count, and confine the sexual relation to the week immediately preceding the onset of menstruation, that period, the week immediately preceding, is quite infertile metal. There's nothing whatever you can do about it. The lady cannot shift it up into there. She can wobble it about a bit, but she can't shift it that far. Now, what she will try to do is convince the male in the case, especially if she's not married to him because she wants a man, that the onset occurred on another day. She will devise some method of misleading him. She'll let him keep the book and then tell him he's forgotten to make an entry. The reality of the situation is that the week immediately preceding menstruation is quite safe. But there's a very peculiar biological tendency in the woman to keep pushing her to say to the man, that is just the time I don't like it. And this he can only overcome by a superior technique. That is to say, he must so justify himself during this period that he actually begins to think that he doesn't need a baby after all. If he can bring the energies within himself to pass, according to the great law, into the opposite, relatively passive side, according to the rule, then this passive side will forget all about bothering to project another child into the future. Because the biological purpose of making a child into the future only arises from the deep consciousness in this generation that we haven't made the grade. And this is a very peculiar thing. Where a man and a woman actually think they have begun to attain the perfection that the biological process aims at, their desire to have children reduces. The more stupid you are, the more determined you are to be producing. There's a biological justification for this, because obviously the stupid should have no handicap. They should be allowed more tries than everybody else. Like in the coconut shy halfway from ladies. Whereas a highly developed being spontaneously begins to think he doesn't need to project himself forward in the time process for a second chance, because he believes that he's made the grade now, or near enough, and he believes he can make it before he dies. So instead of using willpower to try to save this rampant beast in this period, use the willpower to try to confine it to this period. Knowing that the full forces of biology and the necessity of evolution are trying to make you make a false entry in your diary. I'm afraid I'll...